Going through a divorce is daunting and can make you feel financially vulnerable. Ampla Finance can help. Unlike other loans, there's no need for any ongoing monthly repayments. You're only charged loan interest on the amount of money used to pay your solicitor's fees as your case progresses, and the easy-to-use online tool keeps you in full control throughout the process. Your loan is normally repaid in full when you reach settlement, so between now and then, you have peace of mind that the cost of your divorce won't impact your day-to-day needs. Ampla Finance puts you at the heart of everything they do and can help you to make the fresh start you're looking for. To find out more, click the link in the podcast description or visit www.amplafinance.com.
In this episode, I'm talking to Karen Walker, who is an expert in working with narcissistic personality disorder in family law. It's a fascinating conversation where we talk about the difference between achieving a fair outcome and an achievable outcome. We also talk about spending your money in sensible places during the divorce process when you're divorcing someone with narcissistic personality disorder. I hope you enjoy this episode. I really enjoy talking to Karen. Let's jump right in. Hello and welcome to today's episode of the Smart Divorce Podcast. And today I'm really excited to be joined by Karen Walker. I heard Karen speaking at a conference, I'm thinking a month ago, but I'm really not sure. Time seems to be going at a whole different rate at the moment. So it could well be less or more than that, but roughly that. And she was speaking about divorcing a narcissist, on which she is an absolute expert. So thank you, Karen, for joining me today. That's very kind of you.
Well, my pleasure, Tamsin. It's really nice to speak to you.
So I should introduce you properly. So Karen is the founding partner of KGW Family Law, based in Woking. She is a solicitor, mediator, collaborative lawyer, arbitrator, trainer, and author. And I'm having to read that because there are so many different hats that Karen wears. She's also co-written two publications on the area of narcissism in family law, and this is what we're going to be talking about today. So I guess there's one specific aspect of this that I want us to get into the detail of, but I guess before we really get started, it would be worth us attempting to define what narcissism or narcissistic behavior is. So can I throw that over to you to begin with?
Yes, of course. So narcissism is a very particular type of behaviour. In the books to which you've referred, we've set out the narcissist playlist. So they behave in a very particular way. Very often they've suffered some kind of trauma or difficulty in the early years of their own life. And quite a useful tool to use as a practitioner is when you meet with a new client to talk to them not just about their current circumstances, but to drill down a little bit into their background, and you might get some telltale signs of perhaps the loss of a parent at a very young age, or a very bad relationship with a parent, or perhaps going off to boarding school at a very early age, anything like that. It's that sort of event which can cause narcissistic personality disorder to develop. And then what you will tend to find is someone who's got extremely low empathy, who will react to most things in the manner that a four-year-old might. If you attribute all of those sort of tantrumy, very selfish, very self-focused approach to a situation. I think one of the big giveaway signs is an enormous sense of entitlement and also an inability to have any boundaries or to have much of an association with the truth. I think it's important to underline at that juncture that obviously as family lawyers or otherwise, we're not qualified to make diagnoses or anything like that. So it's very much looking at a pattern of behaviour and then having a feel for whether someone behaves in a particular way. You've then got the example of the cycle of idealise, devalue, discard, rinse and repeat, which is very prevalent. As I say, I think the big red flags are this sense of entitlement. So everything is self-focused. no association with the truth. The truth is whatever they want it to be on a given day. A huge desire to win, and to win at all costs, even to their own detriment. So somebody narcissistic will have an objective and they'll want to achieve it. And even if it's to their own personal disadvantage, if they're focused on it, again, like that small child, they can't get that out of their head. So I think that's probably a snapshot of the type of person that one is dealing with. And sadly, because they lack empathy, they're very poor at relationships. And that means that those of us that deal with separating couples encounter them far more than anybody else might. So whilst I think a statistic is that a small sort of 5% of the population may suffer from this or show signs of it, in family law work, that percentage zooms up because we're dealing with those unempathetic people who find it difficult to maintain a relationship.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the words become thrown about, bandied about, used regularly in our world to mean somebody who's very egotistical, perhaps very self-centered. And because we're largely, this is for rather than practitioners, we're talking to the general public, people who might be in a position where they feel that they are divorcing a narcissist. What will they have been experiencing that will be the telltale signs that they see?
I think it's a feeling of being constantly on eggshells, so not really knowing how to deal with this person. I talked about the cycle of idolising and devaluing and discard. So in the first instance, you will have been love bombed. You'll be told you're the most wonderful person that walked the earth. You're their soulmate. They will make you feel as though you're $1 million. And of course, we all like to feel like that.
Absolutely.
They'll also seek people who are vulnerable to being treated like that. So people who perhaps lack self-esteem or lack confidence, because they're very adept at finding someone who meets these needs that they have, who gives them this narcissistic supply. And so I think it's if you're in a relationship where someone makes you feel wonderful, really great about yourself, and then slowly it's chip, chip, chip away at that. And suddenly you think, well, hang on, you know, 2 months ago, I was the best thing that walked the earth. And now everything, every little thing is being criticised, and it's a gradual erosion. And then that will become worse, and to the point that you may find, imagine they're perhaps having a relationship with somebody else, or you know, just their whole demeanour towards you has changed completely. And then as soon as they feel that perhaps you're getting a bit brassed off with this or feeling as though something's wrong, they'll put you back up on that pedestal. So it's that cycle. And once you're sucked into that behaviour pattern, A, it's very difficult to leave. It's a bit scary to leave. And what they're doing to you all the time is trying to maintain control. And you'll find, I think, a number of people to whom I've spoken who know there's something wrong with their relationship but can't quite pinpoint it, when you start to delve in and look at the playlist, as I say, that's set out in the books, it all starts to slot together. And as a lot of people to whom we've spoken have said, when they read the books, it's like reading about their life. Well, it isn't. It's been written about a repetitive behaviour pattern, and that's why it feels like that. But at the risk of being repetitive, I think it's that sense of entitlement that somebody demonstrates and making you feel as their spouse, that you're always not quite sure where you are. It's like being on shifting sand. Are you going to be the most wonderful person ever, or are you going to be criticised at every turn, or some combination of the two? And it feels very unsettling and very unnerving. But when it's good, it's amazing. And that's why it's so hard to pull away from, because you're constantly craving the good times. And that's what they're setting up so that you do, so that you behave. You behave as they want you to, basically. And wanting approval constantly will trigger that.
Wow. Okay.
tricky situation. Not nice,
it is, isn't it? No, and as you say, the book that I've got to get this the right way around, The Lure, the Lost and the Law. find it really difficult to say for some reason. I've certainly recommended it to clients who have said exactly what you said, that it feels that you've written that about my life. And I think that's always a kind of, that's like, all right, okay, this is what we're dealing with in these circumstances. And as you say, it's not about a diagnosis, it's about understanding how to work with that person moving forward and what to expect coming at you from their spouse that they're divorcing. So I think that's really useful to begin with. What I really wanted to focus on today was something that you talked about at your talk at the Northern Lights Conference, which is a fantastic family law conference that
I've been to. It was really enjoyable.
It was absolutely brilliant. It really was. And I came away motivated and had learned absolutely loads, which it means that it's been a good day. If you come away having learned stuff, it's been a good day.
Definitely.
But you were talking particularly about people who are divorcing a narcissist spending money in the right way. And that phrase really hammered home to me. And I wonder if you could expand on that a little bit, because I think this is a really important topic.
I think it's important to remember that narcissistic people like to maintain the chaos and drama of the court process, or they don't really want an outcome. They're looking for ongoing supply, and if they don't get that through adoration and validation, then they can get it through being in control of creating a very difficult situation and perpetuating it. And so they've got no particular desire to bring things to an end, but they also delight in spending somebody else's money because, again, it's a control thing. I think when you've been on the receiving end of this kind of behaviour, you have a real sense of injustice, that you've been treated very badly, that things are not fair. And it's been a massive step to come out of an abusive relationship. It's probably taken a number of attempts and an awful lot of courage and a really big step to break away. And there's the expectation that the court system is going to provide fairness, justice, retribution, all these other things. And sadly, those of us who work within that environment know that court is really the least worst last resort if that's where you have to find yourself, and makes the best out of a difficult set of circumstances, or the best that it can. And so there is, I think, on the part of the person subjected to the behaviour, a willingness to spend money on trying to achieve this fairness. And very often the court is seen as the way to do it, encouraged hugely by the other spouse. I think it's important when you're in this kind of situation, particularly where resources are limited and nobody has a savings account earmarked for divorce costs in the future. It's all money that's being taken out of somewhere else. So it's not really reducing the available resources for the family as a whole. So important resources to conserve as far as you can. But I think very important to think about, where is money worth spending and where are you going to get something back and value for it? And where do you run the risk of wasting money? And having an understanding of that, I think, is really important. If you think about the end of a case, if you think about the end of a case where you've reached an agreement or you've had an adjudication, and you think, right, that's it, done. And the client probably can't get away from lawyers fast enough because they've spent a lot of money and they think, you know, they've had a cost estimate up to the end. And very often lawyers give quite small cost estimates for implementation, which I think can be quite dangerous to do in itself, because where you're dealing with somebody like this, who is looking for loopholes and problems and future opportunity for ongoing litigation, it's so important to draft an order really, really carefully, in quite a lot of detail. And I think important to discuss perhaps with your barrister or your solicitor that this is a really important piece of work and there's going to be a cost to it, but it needs to be done properly. It's not something to be drafted while you're balancing on one knee in the court waiting room or rushed off on some kind of precedent without any proper thought. So I think that's the first point. In circumstances where you're the recipient of ongoing maintenance, a barrister I know well told me many, many years ago that maintenance is only ever as good as the person who pays it. And there's a great deal of truth in that. You can talk about enforcement, and of course enforcement is possible, but it's not straightforward. And inevitably there will be a long gap between failure to pay and ability to enforce, because the court process just is not very quick. So I think it's also very beneficial when you've got your final settlement to go and talk to a financial advisor, somebody who's looking at your financial long-term position, and look at things like, what if this goes wrong? What if I don't get the maintenance for 6 months, a year, ever? How am I going to manage? Where are my strengths and weaknesses? What do I really need to think about? Do I want to take my maximum borrowing capacity now, or might I be better not doing that? What can I really afford to spend on a property? So having a real sort of health check financially, and also to think about the what ifs if this goes wrong, because narcissistic former partners are not renowned for paying what they're supposed to pay, and will mess around with things. So I think those are always very, very valuable pieces of work to undertake. And I think that when cost estimates are given, it's important to build that in and look at the real benefit that that sort of thing can achieve. Where I think it's important not to spend money is, I talked at the conference about the difference between fair and achievable, and there is a big difference between those two things. Sadly, life's not fair, as I think was Scar famously said in The Lion King when my children were small. And that's very, very true. It isn't fair. And you're very fortunate if you manage to achieve fairness. And so, but because those who have been subjected to an abusive relationship will feel that somebody's now going to put this right, that it's going to be made better, they become reliant on something, someone to achieve that for them. And to take as a very simple example, if you have a child arrangements order and the children are supposed to come home at 6 o'clock on a Sunday, well, narcissists will bring them back at 5:30, 7:10, any variation, but probably not 6 o'clock. There's a huge desire in those circumstances to run back to your lawyer. Oh, they were late. They're always late. I've got an order. They need to be told. I need to go back to court to have this enforced. Yeah. Point one, rarely are those sorts of orders enforced very well. Point two, your narcissistic ex-partner will want you to spend money, will want to have achieved a drama, and best of all, will want to know, well, that worked, that's caused an upset. I'm back centre stage in this situation, so I'm going to do this again. And I now know that it does work, so I'm going to look at what other aspect of this order I could mess around with. Safe in the knowledge that actually doing something about that can be quite futile. And so spending money on that sort of thing, rather than when they arrive late just saying, oh dear, the traffic must have been bad, never mind, goodbye, or oh gosh, you've come early, that's great, kids, you can come in and do this and help me cook dinner or whatever, just really calm it down and not rise to it, and they'll stop because they're not getting anything back from it and you're saving money. So I think, I don't know what your experience has been, Tamsin, in that kind of area, but for me, it's about picking battles. Don't fight a battle you can't win. even if you feel you've got right on your side, because narcissists aren't interested in what's right or wrong. They're interested in getting the attention and the feeling of being in control that starting a squabble or a battle provokes for them. And then maintaining that is better still, because that's their real source of supply. If they try to provoke or pick a fight and they get nothing back, they'll move on to something else because they're not achieving anything. And so it's about evaluating, what can I really do about this? And also, you know, I sound as though I'm saying there's no point in getting an order. That's entirely wrong. It's really important to have a detailed order and a detailed roadmap. But it's also quite important to talk to the person who's putting that order together and to find out just how enforceable parts of it are. You know, time and again, kind of flipping it round to when parents are expecting to see their children and then the other parent won't let them or says they're poorly or whatever. They think they can take their piece of paper to the police station and the police officer these children. It doesn't work like that. But I think very often people have a misconception of what an order can and can't achieve. So again, spending some time identifying that so that you recognise it's all very well having an order, but how are you going to enforce it? Or should you just let it go? Because actually you're going to spend money that you don't have, achieve very little, and it's not really a great benefit.
Yeah, I think that's brilliant advice. I love that example of you know, they come home early or late and you just go, oh, thank you very much for bringing them back. Bye.
Which is really hard to do, because if you might be in the box thinking they're coming home an hour later and suddenly your life's turned upside down, or you know, you've been waiting for them and there's that big worry if children don't come back on time, you know, are they on a plane to Dubai or, you know, all sorts of really scary things. So and when you have been traumatized and you may well be suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder with all everything that brings with it, so it's very easy to sort of catastrophize a situation, and it just heightens your own anxiety.
Yeah, absolutely. And I am the world's best at doing stuff like that. Absolutely, sit in those shoes. And I think you're right. I think it is. It's that difference between getting an order so everybody knows where they stand, and getting an order to think that something's immediately going to happen differently. They're two different things, but although they're the same, you know, it is, you do need everything written down. You do need the detail in it. You do need to understand what may or may not happen afterwards. And I think that's vitally important. You talked before about maintenance, ongoing maintenance, and the likelihood of the ex paying or not paying. The preference, from what I can gather that you're saying, and this would be my view as well, it sounds like if there's an option of not having ongoing maintenance and taking capital sum instead, even if it's a little bit lower, that would be preferable than relying on ongoing maintenance that may or may not turn up.
Definitely. I mean, the rules say that the court must consider a clean break in every case. So it's not just may, they must. So the objective for the court is to try to sever people financially if it's achievable. Where you're dealing with somebody who's narcissistic, that's even more important, because it's going to take away a point of contact and a dependency. If you think about the fact they want to be in control, or somebody providing someone with part or all of their income, which meets their needs, is a pretty big control to have.
Absolutely.
And if you can take that away, then all the better. And, you know, back to fair and achievable, sometimes if you can get a clean break, even though it might mean that you're going to take less than you might have been advised would be fair, if a clean break is achievable and you could manage, and it's within the bracket of what a court would see as reasonable, then the fact that you become the author or authoress of your own future financially is vitally important. And it just removes that opportunity for messing around in the future, or every month just wondering, am I going to get my money this month or not? Yeah. And because things tend to be paid just after the paying person has been paid, so a little bit further towards the end of the month, and because most people's standing orders are set up at the beginning of the month, you know, you could have just 2 or 3 days of complete crisis, not knowing where to turn. And that's why I said earlier, I think, you know, having that conversation to look at, if disaster struck, how would I get myself through a few months? You know, is it worth trying to put some money on one side? Or how would I deal with this? Because again, there may be a period of time with almost nothing, and to literally have no money in your bank account is a very, very unpleasant experience.
Yeah, absolutely terrifying. I think our kind of view is always try and have kind of, if you possibly can, 3 to 6 months of your bills covered, of your lifestyle covered in a pot somewhere else, just so that you know if the worst comes to the worst, there's something there and the bills can be paid and food can be put on the table, because it's terrifying not to be in that position. We talked about using the courts and about how your narcissist ex is likely to use the courts, and these cases often go all the way because there's no desire to settle at an FDR, and we're all the way to the final hearing, and heaps of money has been spent. Is there ever an opportunity in these circumstances to avoid that, to attempt the dispute resolution route, or is that just, that's just not going to work?
No, I think there is. You've got that balance between somebody narcissistic wanting to perpetuate the drama and stay in this sort of muddle that is sorting things out. Against, they quite like to feel special. So if you can sell to them that ADR, arbitration, mediation is for the for the discerning person who's going to settle things in a very grown up and very future focused way, a quite innovative way, then that plays to their inner ego and think, oh well, you know, I'm a very special person, so I would like to adopt this opportunity. I don't think that mediation in its classic form with the mediator and the couple together works particularly well, because I'm not saying it never works, but I think there's a real danger of setting up a triangle and for the narcissist to switch between rescuer and perpetrator and victim and spin that circle. But I think that if you have a mediator who understands the dynamic that's going on, recognises the need to win on one side and the desire to get out on the other, and can help facilitate the creation of an outcome which meets the needs of both. And if you're very, very skilled at it, you will help create an outcome where the narcissist thinks they've won, but actually they haven't. That their spouse has already thought 3 steps ahead of them and has put forward a proposal, knowing that they will come back with something less and knowing that they will be prepared to accept that. So I think that can work extremely well. Arbitration, I think, works well because it's very much presented as for those who want to be a bit more sensible about things. It's a little, and I think anything that smacks of being a private system or something a little bit elevated, which it isn't at all, but I think you can sell it as though it is. It actually works extremely well for people who have very limited resources, because it's quicker and it can be extremely cost effective. But I think you can sell it as that sort of higher level of dealing with things. Anything like that is very likely to work. Similarly, I think mutual evaluation is a very underused tool, where you bring in somebody to just give a view about what they think the outcome should be. And I think the fact that it's used infrequently makes a narcissist feel, oh, this is quite unique, and they think that I would warrant this. So I think that can work well. And definitely don't think that ADR should be ruled out. I think the difficulty is that the narcissist will want to prolong matters. Yeah. And so you've got to find a reason why prolonging it isn't great. I think also cutting down the communication. So, and I think lawyers can think about this as well, that if you don't respond to letters all the time and you kind of leave things and reply in one go to 16 different emails or whatever else you might have received, the narcissist doesn't feel that they're getting that instant ping-pong fix. So they ping an email out. They want an immediate reaction, and ideally an immediate to-ing and fro-ing or creation of a bit of a moment in this, or because that's what makes them feel good about themselves, and they sense the attention that they're immediately getting. If that doesn't happen, then they may become slightly less interested in this court process. So then to turn their focus to something which does make them feel special, i.e. an ADR process which isn't used quite so much, can work to the advantage of everyone.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I was going to ask you about communication between solicitors, I guess, because my understanding, and I'm not a lawyer, is that solicitors are acting on their client's instructions. So if they're told to send a letter over and over again, and I'm assuming this is the sort of behaviour that we can expect from a narcissist, that they're obligated to do that. How much space do they have?
I think it depends on the individual as to how they run their practice. But yes, you do act on instructions. So you can give your client the most sensible advice in the world. If they're not prepared to listen to it, that's their prerogative. And you would stop acting for someone if there's a breakdown in confidence between solicitor and client. Actually, that's quite easy to create in a narcissistic environment, because probably they criticised you more than once. So, because they treat their lawyer in the same way that they would treat their former partner. I think it's important to think about, from your own perspective as a lawyer, what you're contributing towards. So, we're all really busy. So you might not have time to get that letter out as an immediately bombarding the other person. I don't send things out on a Friday afternoon late unless it's something pretty simple and straightforward. So you might say to your narcissistic client, sorry, we don't send correspondence out later, but this will have to go on Monday. And I think you can do that without not following instructions. So sure. You can have some kind of moderating to it, quite sort of topically as we zoom our way towards Christmas. again, when we had fault-based divorce, occasionally we would be asked to issue divorce proceedings on Christmas Eve or make sure that they arrived on Christmas Eve. Now, as a practitioner, I would never do that, instructed or otherwise. It's just not appropriate in my view. And I was asked on a few occasions. I always said no. Particularly if there are children, but for all kinds of reasons, because it would arrive on Christmas Eve. Most people are closed then until January. You can't get advice. So I just wouldn't do it. But I'm sure, well, I know that there are people who would and did. I'm sure that because we now have an online system, there might well be people who would log on and do said things on Christmas Eve or Christmas Day, who knows. But yes, of course, lawyers have to take instructions and act on instructions, and that can become a shield to hide behind. But there's also a way of practicing, and I think that, and it's again about boundaries. I said about not sending things out late on a Friday, and so on. So I think you set your own professional boundaries. And if you have clients who want to push those, you just say no. You know, if you have a client who wants to ring you at 11 o'clock at night, I don't know, speak to clients then, you just say no.
I'm asleep.
And but you know, boundaries, big or small, are important. And absolutely. I think we have to, as professionals, set our own professional boundaries. Probably another indicator of whether somebody suffers from NPD or not. Back to my earlier point about entitlement and boundaries, they think they can control you. And you've got to act in their best interests, and you take their instructions, but you still maintain your professional boundaries.
Yeah, absolutely. And as a solicitor on the receiving end of, let's say, the solicitor on the working for the narcissist had less strict boundaries than someone like yourself, and was bombarding your solicitor with correspondence. Does that correspondence need to be all passed on to your client?
No, I don't think it does. I think you can agree with your client things like, you know, I'm not going to send you everything. If they don't want to have everything, again, that's their instructions. They should do. And you would write and want to say, you do need to know everything. This is your life, not mine. But if you know it's going to upset them, you might want to pick the phone up first and tell them what the content of the email or letter is. You might want to put in the heading of the email that you send to them, "This is fine, don't be worried about opening it." Because sometimes when you're the recipient, and I know it sounds amusing, but when you are the recipient and you get an email and you think, you know, you go cold and you think, God, what's going to be in this? And it might just be, is the valuation report for something. So nothing to be alarmed about at all. And I think conveying that, because you don't know what's in an email until you've opened it, is again important. And I think having that conversation, back to spending money at the right time, having that conversation with your client right at the outset, so that you're setting boundaries and parameters and you have an understanding with them that something that is likely to be hurtful or difficult, you'll talk through with them rather than just sending it out. And the worst thing you could do as a lawyer in those circumstances is just ping something out with no covering anything, especially on a Friday afternoon, and then trash someone's weekend. So you'd be sensible about how you deal with that. I think if you've got a solicitor on the other side who's bombarding you with hostile correspondence, I'd pick up the phone and, you know, suss out first of all whether they give a deep sigh and say, "This is my worst case, I can't wait for it to be over, I'm so sorry I'm sending you this stuff, but I've got to," or words to that effect. Or that they might be the complete other end of that scale and be quite hostile themselves. And then at least you know where you are when you're from your practice perspective. I'm a great fan of picking up the phone. I think we hide behind the written word far too much now. Which is a shame.
Yeah, I'm absolutely with you. I think there's a massive danger in the written word, because it's always received in a different way. It's often received in a different way than which it was written, because you'll receive it in the emotional state that you're in at the time that you read it. And we can read all sorts of things into emails that aren't intended. I think the creation of the emoji has massively helped with this, and that sounds ridiculous, but something, you know, a word like somebody could write "great." Well, I could be in "great" as in, "That's absolutely fantastic, brilliant, I'm so chuffed." Or it could be a really sarcastic, "Oh, great." You know, and you can't tell from that one word, and emails are exactly the same. So I'm with you. I think you can absolutely, from somebody's tone of voice and somebody's and their language they use on the phone, much more easily work out who they are and where they're coming from than in an email. So yeah, I think that's really, really interesting and really useful to know kind of how you're dealing with these things. And you're comment about the note on the email about naming the email is so incredibly useful. One of my clients was having a terrible time with her ex, and she said, can I just ping the email straight to you? Like, I don't even want to open it, but when it comes to me, can I just send it straight on? And I was like, yeah, of course you can. And she's like, then you read it and tell me what it says. So it was like, absolutely no problem whatsoever. But these are, you know, the situations we're dealing with. People are going through divorce or in heightened state of emotion at the end of the day, aren't they?
Very much so, yeah. And I think anything that as professionals involved we can do to alleviate that is really important.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. Really horribly, we're at the end of our time together, Karen. Is there anything that I should have asked you that I didn't, or that you would like to add in summary before we part ways?
No, I don't think so. I think that's covered what I thought would be useful. You know, I think as we discussed at the conference, this idea of when people perhaps don't want to spend money but should, and when they are very ready to spend money but shouldn't, is quite an important aspect.
Yeah, absolutely. Vitally important. Completely agree. And I love the difference between fair and achievable. I think that's a massively important takeaway that people can get from this podcast. Karen, thank you so much for joining me. It's been an absolute pleasure.
It's been a pleasure to see you too. Thank you so much for asking me.
Hi, and I hope you enjoyed that episode of the Smart Divorce podcast. If you would like to get in touch, please have a look in the show notes for our details, or go onto the website www.smartdivorce.co.uk. Also, if you are listening on Apple Podcasts or on Spotify and you wouldn't mind leaving us a lovely 5-star review, that would be fantastic. I know that lots of our listeners are finding this is incredibly helpful in their journey through separation, divorce, and dissolving a civil partnership. Also, if you would like some further support, we do have a Facebook group now. It's called Separation, Divorce, and Dissolution UK. Please do go on to Facebook, search up the group, and we'd be delighted to have you join us. The one thing I would say is do please answer their membership questions. Okay, have a great day and take care.